The second case for oral argument this morning is Scott Erisman, appellant versus Douglas Muth, appellate. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael Henderson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Stephen Morgans, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Henderson, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes. Just a minute. Court should acknowledge that Justice Sabres has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Jeanine Curran, a judge from the 7th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Sabres' place. Mr. Henderson, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Henderson, a lawyer from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant in this case, Scott Erisman. The fundamental question I think that this case presents is whether a party who admits to constructing and selling real property or property in their pleadings can avoid liability stemming from the sale of that property simply because an initial purchase agreement between the parties, which was later replaced by a contract for deed, incorrectly identified a third party as the seller. This case stems from the sale of...
So is this a matter... So the judge, Sirskin, determined that as a matter of law, that the purchase agreement control. Is that right?
That's my understanding of Judge Sirskin's decision, is that because the purchase agreement identified the parties as my client, Scott Erisman, and Cisco Financial Group, which is a LLC... controlled by the defendant and appellee Doug Muth, that because the Cisco Financial Group was the party to the purchase agreement, that there was no duty owed by Doug Muth individually to Scott Erisman.
What is the connection? What is the connection between the purchase agreement and the contract for deed? I know that in many cases, you know, a realtor will have people sign a purchase agreement, and then later on there's a more formal document prepared.
Right.
Is there a connection like that here between these two or not?
The explanation for why there was both a purchase agreement and a contract for deed in this case is basically the purchase agreement was signed in March of 2003, contemplated a closing date of April 30th, I believe, of 2003. Scott Erisman was unable to obtain the financing he needed to purchase these properties at that time. So the closing never happened, never went through. But he remained interested in purchasing the property, and thereafter the party executed a contract for deed in May of 2003, in which he agreed to purchase the property on a contract for deed. Later on, he was able to obtain financing and paid off the contract for deed in its entirety. And at that point, the warranty deed transferring the property from Doug Muth to Scott Erisman was executed. So that's the explanation for that. Basically what happened is these were one 10-plex and two 4-plexes in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They were built in 2001 and 2002. In his answer to the complaint, the appellee, Doug Muth, admitted that he constructed the property, was the general contractor for the construction of the property, and sold the property to Scott Erisman. The property was at some point listed for sale with a real estate agent named Jeremy Muth. Scott Erisman became interested in purchasing the property, and in March of 2003, as I mentioned, signed a purchase agreement. That was then replaced, essentially, by the contract for deed. And, you know, my reading of the appellee's brief is that they acknowledged that the contract for deed, in effect, replaced the purchase agreement. The property was ultimately transferred by warranty deed from Doug Muth to Scott Erisman. And the key to all of this is, while the initial purchase agreement identified Cisco Financial Group as the seller, the subsequent contract for deed, which replaced the purchase agreement, identified Doug Muth individually as the seller, made no mention of Cisco Financial Group.
Why does the court draw, I mean, in the trial court's memorandum decision, it never mentions the contract for deed. Do you have an explanation for that?
I do believe that the trial court's memorandum decision does briefly mention the contract for deed. if we look at page, page 11 of our appendix, the trial court does mention that that there was a contract for deed recorded with the register of deed that lists Doug Muth and Charity Muth as the sellers of the property. The trial court acknowledges that, also acknowledges that there was the warranty deed transferring the property was executed by Doug Muth and Charity Muth individually, and then goes on to simply say, nevertheless, the purchase agreement was between Cisco Financial Group.
I guess my question then is that, you know, the court, you're right, I stand corrected, it does mention it, but then it goes right on to use the purchase agreement as the, apparently, the controlling document. Do you know why it did that?
I don't know that I have a very good answer for that. I think that that was error on the part of the trial court to consider the purchase agreement as the controlling document. That purchase agreement never closed, and in essence, I think everybody agrees that the contract for deed that was executed subsequently to that, in essence, replaced that purchase agreement.
Now, if I remember right from law school, a contract for deed that merges into a warranty deed, right?
That is correct.
How about the purchase agreement? Does that also merge, or does that have some other legal standing?
I think that the purchase agreement, given the fact that the purchase agreement never closed on the contemplated date, I think it became, the reason it didn't close is because Scott Ashman was unable to obtain financing. I think from a legal standpoint, I think that the purchase agreement is really a nullity. It doesn't mean anything. It was an agreement between the parties that he purchased the property contingent upon him obtaining that financing. He was unable to obtain it, and therefore that agreement never closed. And obviously the parties still were interested in consummating the transaction and therefore executed the contract for deed. But I don't know that the purchase agreement, from a legal standpoint, has really any effect.
Was there any other reason that the trial court based its or granted the summary judgment? Other than the purchase agreement showing those names, were there other reasons?
My reading of, first of all, there's several different claims that our complaint made. We made a claim for negligence, a claim for a breach of implied warranty, and then claims for fraud and for negligent misrepresentation. The primary reason, I think, on all of them, and I think certainly the only reason on both the negligence and the implied warranty claims that the trial court granted summary judgment, was its determination that Doug Muth owed Scott Ashman no duty because he was not a party to the purchase agreement. I think that the appellee has essentially acknowledged that, and has made essentially in their submissions to the court now, has made basic different positions, or positions to, in support of the trial court's decision, which are different than that both relied upon by the trial court. One is that the notion that regardless of who was the seller and the owner of the property and who was the party to the contract for deed, that Cisco Financial Group was the general contractor, that they were the ones responsible for constructing the property. And quite simply, there's minimal evidence to support that, and it is directly contrary to the judicial admissions made by defendant Doug Muth in his answer to our complaint. We allege in our complaint that he was both the seller and the general contractor responsible for constructing the property, and in his answer he admitted that. That's never been amended. He's never sought permission to amend it. And absent that, I think that judicial admission alone establishes that he was the general contractor, and at the very least is enough to create a question of fact as to whether he was the general contractor. The other argument that Mr. Muth's counsel makes on appeal is the idea that this was a resale situation to a subsequent purchaser. And quite frankly, the evidence in the record does not support that notion in any way. Once again, Doug Muth acknowledges in his answer that he was the general contractor responsible for constructing the property, that he owned the property, that he sold the property to Scott Ashman. There's no in-between purchaser here. And the idea of a subsequent purchaser would necessarily contemplate that the builder of the property sells it to a separate party, and then that separate party sells it to the plaintiff. That didn't happen here. It was sold directly from the general contractor and builder and owner to my client, Scott Erschman. So it was one sale. There's no resale here. There was no previous sale whatsoever. One other point I would make while on the notion of who was the party to the agreement between the parties. In addition to the contract for deed, which clearly identifies Doug Muth as the seller, in addition to the warranty deed that also identifies him as the seller, and in fact affects the conveyance of the property from Doug Muth to Scott Erschman, there's also the judicial admissions between in which Doug Muth admits that he was the seller and builder of the property. And there is no deed or other document in the record at any point which ever indicates that Cisco Financial Group, Doug Muth's LLC, ever had any ownership interest in this property. The only warranty deed in the record is the deed transferring the property from Doug Muth to Scott Erschman. There's nothing in terms of documentary evidence, in terms of a warranty deed or something like that, that would indicate that Cisco Financial Group ever owned the property. The idea that they were the seller of the property just doesn't make much sense. I think what we have here is a situation in which the initial purchase agreement misidentified the seller of the property. And because that agreement was never consummated and was replaced by the contract for deed, it's really a non-issue. In addition to the negligence and breach of implied warranty claims we made, we also made claims for fraud and negligent misrepresentation. On both of those issues, part of the trial court's analysis was the same, and was essentially that Doug Muth wasn't a party to the contract and therefore doesn't have any duty.
When you say essentially the same, does that mean that if we were to rule in your favor on the contract for deed, purchase agreement, warranty deed issue, that we would not have to reach the trial court's rationale on the individual causes of action?
I think that as I read the trial court's decision, I think that basic fact was, or that basic analysis of the trial court, the idea that Doug Muth wasn't a party to the purchase agreement and therefore doesn't owe any duty, I think that was a part of the trial court's analysis with respect to each of our claims, each four counts of our complaint. And I think that it's so fundamentally incorrect and inconsistent with the record that I think that if the court is to determine that the purchase agreement was not controlling and that the contractor deed replaced it and that Doug Muth was in fact a party to the transaction between the parties, that would essentially require a reversal of all counts. I don't know if that answers your question.
Did you file a cross motion for summary judgment?
We did not file a cross motion for summary judgment.
Okay, so all you want is trial.
Exactly. Okay. And from our standpoint, clearly, there are questions of fact here. We don't believe, didn't believe we were in a position to prove as a matter of law that we were entitled to relief, but you're exactly right. What we're simply asking for is a determination that there are material issues of fact here, that summary judgment was inappropriate, and this matter should be remanded so that it can proceed to trial. In terms of the substance of the fraud and negligent misrepresentation claims, Doug Muth has indicated, and quite correctly, that he didn't have any conversations directly with Scott Erschman prior to the sale. Now, the basis for those claims, and I think it's fairly clear in our briefs, is there was a listing agreement which identified this property as being for sale. Part of that listing agreement, it was a listing agreement with identifying Jeremy Muth as the seller's agent. That listing agreement indicated that the vinyl siding on the property was maintenance-free, and that's the fundamental representation, which we believe was untrue and is the basis for our fraud and negligent misrepresentation claims. The reality is that, you know, shortly after Scott Erishman purchased the property, he began immediately having problems with the vinyl siding, tried to repair it on a number of occasions, continued to have problems, and continues to have those problems today. At some point, he had an engineer come out and look at it and determined that the siding was essentially incorrectly installed, and that the nails in the siding were driven in too far. It should have been not driven in as far, so that there was a little bit of room, so that there was some give to the siding.
So did the trial court take those facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which would have been your party, and give it any credence whatsoever?
The trial court. It's difficult for me to answer that. What the trial court did was appear to give credence to those allegations, and then mentioned, I believe, at some point that the source of this representation was Jeremy Muth, who was the seller's real estate agent in this case. And then the trial court went on to say, but, you know, Jeremy Muth was the seller's agent, and the seller in this case was Cisco Financial Group, and therefore he wasn't acting on behalf of, while a principal may be liable for an agent's misrepresentations, he wasn't acting on behalf of Doug Muth, he was acting on behalf of Cisco Financial Group. So it all kind of came back to that.
Did that precede the purchase agreement?
I'm sorry?
The realtor's agreement.
Yes, the listing prepared by the realtor preceded the purchase agreement, and I'm not. It is not dated, but it was. There's testimony that the listing agreement was provided to Scott Erishman when he went to look at the property, when he became interested in purchasing the property, and before he signed the purchase agreement. One point that I want to respond to that is mentioned in the brief of the appellee is the idea that. That there's no evidence that Jeremy Muth was the agent for Doug Muth, and I think that it's an argument that was not really made at the trial court level. But what we have here is we have clearly a situation where Doug Muth admits that he was the seller. All evidence indicates that he was the owner and seller of the property. Jeremy Muth, everybody agrees, was the seller's agent in this case. And the idea that he was somehow the agent for someone else, like Cisco Financial Group, I think is just inconsistent with the basic fact that Doug Muth was the owner and seller here.
Does the listing agreement indicate who Jeremy Muth was working for?
The listing agreement does not indicate who Jeremy was working for, no. There is testimony in the record that... When Scott Erishman became interested in buying the property, that he and his agent looked at the property with Jeremy Muth, who was the seller's agent. But no, there's no direct statement in the listing agreement that indicates who he is representing, other than the seller. In conclusion, the appellee in this case, Doug Muth, has essentially, at every turn, tried to run from his responsibilities as the seller here. At the trial court level, the argument was made that he wasn't the owner or seller of the property. An argument that was ultimately essentially adopted by the circuit court. On appeal, it seems to me, at least reading the appellee's brief, that they acknowledge that there may be at least a question of fact as to whether he is the seller or owner, and that the real question is whether he's the general contractor. That's a matter that he's admitted in his answer. We alleged in our complaint that he was the general contractor responsible for construction of the property. He admitted that. That's never been amended. He's never sought permission to amend it. And I think that has the effect of a judicial admission. And I would ask the court to reverse this matter, reverse the trial court's grant of summary judgment, and remand the matter so that Mr. Erishman can proceed with the trial. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you.
Mr. Morgans, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Steve Morgans. I represent the defendant and appellee, Doug Muth, in this matter. It's defendant's and appellee's position that the trial court's summary judgment decision granting, dismissing all the plaintiff's causes of action should be affirmed in all respects.
Are we limited by his opinion, his decision, because he incorporated it into the order? If there are times when we've said we'll approve of a summary judgment even if the trial court granted it for the wrong reasons, but since he put it in the order, are we bound then for the reasons that he's given for this summary judgment? Because you argue some things he did not address.
That's correct, Your Honor. We do argue some rationales, and just to back up for a moment, it is our position that while there's been a lot of discussion on the ownership of the property, that is not a controlling issue on the causes of action that are being presented. But to answer your question, it is our position that the trial court, or that the summary judgment can be affirmed on other grounds based on the record that exists, and we believe that the record that exists that was presented to the trial court and argued to the trial court was sufficient to grant summary judgment.
So you think we can, even though he incorporated that decision in the order, we can find some other reason to affirm it?
Well, I think when you read his decision, I know there have been a lot of questions about what was his thinking here, what was his basis here, did he incorporate or did he rely upon that? And I understand that it's a longer decision and it's maybe not entirely clear, but it's our position, Your Honor, that the basis of that decision, as you read through there, that the premises for the granting of summary judgment, even on the points that we argue on this appeal, are incorporated in the decision. Now, whether the Judge Sirsky, the trial court, relied heavier on the fact that Cisco owned it at the time, we may say that, that's not entirely clear, that at least for purposes of appeal, we'll grant that fact because of the subsequent purchase or the subsequent warranty deed.
Do you concede that then?
We
that Cisco was not the owner of the property, but rather Muth?
For purposes of this appeal, we concede that there are fact issues on the ownership issue. But it's our position, Your Honor, that ownership issue, when you talk about the causes of action that are being presented and that are being addressed in front of this court today, that the ownership issue is not the controlling factor in deciding those issues.
Was there a statement of undisputed facts that was filed in here? I noticed it's not attached to any of the briefs.
There is not. What I'd like to do first, because we have two sides of the coin here. We have the sale of the property and the construction of the property, and I think the causes of action are more neatly assigned to each of those separate actions. I'd like to focus on the sale of the property first, and we're talking about the fraud, the deceit, the negligent misrepresentation claims. In order for there to be a genuine issue of material fact for plaintiff to proceed to trial on those counts, there must be some affirmative representation made by the defendant that is false. It's our position that...
Are we at a disadvantage because... I'm sorry to interrupt you again,
that's okay.
But I'm kind of hung up on the statement of undisputed facts. Aren't we at some kind of a disadvantage here? We don't even know what those are. You made the motion. Did you? You made the summary judgment motion.
Defendants did, yes.
And you didn't attach any undisputed facts to support your motion? Is that right?
At that point of appeal, I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Aren't we at a disadvantage here? I mean, how could the trial court, how can anybody look at this and say, here are the undisputed facts? I think there was a local rule, and now we have a statewide rule that says you have to attach that
to your summary judgment motion.
And the reason for that is the reason we're trying, you know, that we're struggling here is because we don't even know what the undisputed facts were.
And whether based on those undisputed facts, the court made the right decision. Isn't there a problem with that?
I understand your position and the dilemma the court's faced with in that regard, Your Honor. It's defendants and the appellee's position that there are not undisputed facts on the relevant issues and that it would not matter.
Tell me what those are then. They're not in the record.
Well, in the judge's decision, the trial court goes through those facts, but it's our position, Your Honor, that we have plaintiff pursuing their cause of action. They have to identify some type of representation that occurred here. And that representation has to be a false representation by our client, the defendant in this case. It's our position, regardless of what the trial court relied upon in the record, that there is no genuine issues of material fact that would allow a plaintiff to pursue those causes of action. It is their burden to produce some type of affirmative evidence to establish those causes of action.
How about the statement by Jeremy Muth in the listing agreement that the siding was maintenance-free?
That is a good question, Your Honor. The question is, first of all, there's a few things to address on whether that would apply to my client. And I think the most critical point, and I know we've addressed several in our brief, but I think the most critical point for the court to consider is whether there's any evidence whatsoever in the record that there was any justifiable reliance upon that representation, even assuming that representation was made by my client's agent, which we would have to determine that Jeremy was his agent, that he was acting in the scope of his agency at the time he made that representation. Even assuming those facts, there's no evidence that plaintiff, Mr. Ayersman, relied upon that in the purchase of this property.
Was that part of your motion? What exactly was your motion? I don't think I have that in front of me either.
The motion for summary.
You have the burden initially on the summary judgment.
Right.
To show there are no issues of material fact. I'm still not understanding what that was.
The motion was based on the fact, Your Honor, that, and maybe a little background here, and I was not involved in the case at that time, but what happened was the defense are presented with a complaint alleging these causes of action of fraud and deceit and negligent misrepresentation. And when you look at the complaint, you see a false representation. There's a general allegation that there's a false representation as to structural problems. So the defendants do the next step and say, okay, we'll send discovery, interrogatories, request for reduction. Please identify what those issues were, what was a misrepresentation, and what was the misrepresentation? What are the documents to support the misrepresentation? At no point in these discovery requests, in the request for reduction of documents, was this listing sheet ever produced. Then we moved to plaintiff Mr. Ayersman's deposition, and his deposition is taken, and he has examined all the way through about he has purchased this property, and at that time, it's the first time I think he starts testifying about the fact that, well, did you meet my client or talk to him before this purchase of this property? No, I didn't. So the first time was when you went to the closing. Yes, it was. Did you have any substantive conversations? No. And so the wheels start turning that in order to have some type of statement or reliance on a statement, there had to have been something before the purchase of the property. That, and I'm kind of giving you a long story, Judge or Justice, to get to the background of where we're at, what precipitated the summary judgment motion.
But it started with the fact that Mr. Ayersman had never had any contact with our client before the closing on that property. And so the question is, what did he rely upon? And then it gets us back to the listing agreement. But it's interesting, in his deposition, in his own testimony, when he's asked about what representations were made, there's no mention of the listing agreement. At one point he talks about, well, when I did my, I think it was during the walk around, there were some conversations about the siding being maintenance free. Well, he's not sure. He's asked, well, did Jeremy Muth make that statement? Or Mike Foley was the purchaser's listing agent. Do you know who made that statement? He was not even sure who made that statement. It wasn't until his counsel re-examined him that he produced the exhibit of the listing agreement and said, did you receive this before? Yes. It says maintenance free. Yes. And it wasn't maintenance free. But that's all we have on the record, in the certified record, as far as what the reliance is. And it's our position that there is nothing to support plaintiffs proceeding with these causes of action on the sale of the property.
So, what am I understanding then? What you're saying is the undisputed fact that he had no conversation, that Scott Ayersman had a conversation with Muth prior to the contract for deed about any of the conditions of the siding, is an undisputed fact that is dispositive of this issue, or of this case.
Correct, at least on the causes of action on the sale.
All of them? All the causes of action?
On the sale of the property, Your Honor. Because in all the causes of action, I think there's incorporated a reliance element that is necessary. And plaintiffs have not come forth, either through the deposition testimony or otherwise, to show that he relied, in fact, the history of it. When you see how this came about, when there was no mention of this listing agreement all the way through until it was realized they hadn't talked to him, I think that common sense dictates that that does not create a genuine issue of material fact. In fact, in Ayersman's deposition testimony, he indicated when he's asked, did Jeremy Muth make any misrepresentations to you? And he denied that he made any misrepresentations. So defendants in this case have been trying to identify what is it that the allegations are being made against Doug Muth.
So you're saying even with the implied warranty, that falls as well?
That moves us over to the construction claims, Your Honor, and I think...
Are those still alive, then?
Well, it's our position they are not, Your Honor. Again, when you start talking about the construction, the implied warranty claims, although there's been a lot of discussion and briefing about ownership, it's our position that the ownership of the property at that time is irrelevant. The question is, did Doug Muth, as a defendant, construct the property? That's the allegation. Or did he have could he be liable for a breach of implied warranty? That obviously leads into the issue of what's in the answer, what's in the interrogatories, and it's defendant Moose's position, Your Honor, that while there is an acknowledgement in the answer when there's an assertion in the complaint about were you the general or under information and belief, defendant Muth was the general contractor, and that we acknowledge that that's admitted. Obviously, that's in the record. But it's our position that once further discovery is attempted, and it obviously wasn't clear to Mr. Ayersman, because they follow up with a whole set of discovery questions saying, who was the general contractor? Were you the general contractor, or were some company that you owned the general contractor? And all these questions are clarified. Well, Cisco Financial Group was a contractor. I find it...
Yeah, but that's not undisputed, is it?
That...
Isn't it disputed about whether Cisco was the contractor?
It's our position, Your Honor, that it's not in dispute that Cisco was a general contractor.
And then Muth had no general contractor status whatsoever.
That's correct.
Based on what?
Based on what is, I mean, we have, and I know you guys, the court understands that there's no depositions of our clients in this case, and we're relying upon the answers to discovery. But these questions were asked very specifically about the relationship between the parties in his building, and defendant Muth goes through very specifically, yes, I was involved as the general contractor on behalf of Cisco Financial Group, which, by the way, is, while we know that the purchase agreement ultimately did not go through for reasons unrelated to ownership issues, we do know that had there not been issues on the plaintiff's end, that would have went through with Cisco Financial Group being the listed as the owner. And I'm not, and but essentially, Cisco Group is identified as a general, that Doug Muth is working for Cisco as a general contractor in the construction of the buildings. He identifies who the people that worked on the buildings were. There's no evidence that he had any knowledge of any problems with the siding before the sale of the property. There's no evidence.
Let me give you that, and let me just come back to ownership.
Okay.
Since you concede there's, for purposes of summary judgment only, there could be an issue of fact on ownership. Doesn't implied warranty stand? I mean, if you concede there's an issue of fact about ownership, it seems to me that implied warranty stands.
Well, I think that question, Your Honor, takes us into the line of cases that talk about the implied warranty, the Wagner cases and the Brown v. Fowler, South Dakota cases on ownership. And it's defendants reading on those, Your Honor, that specifically in the Brown v. Fowler case, where it says that in some instances, essentially, that a subsequent purchaser or that a builder can be responsible to a subsequent purchaser. But they specify, that this court specifies, that one of the critical elements or one of the two things that need to be met is whether the residence or property was constructed for the purchaser, which is not true in this case, or whether it was alternatively a spec or construction and just built for the public in general. And so it's our position, Your Honor, that there's not genuine issues of material fact as to whether this was constructed for Ayersman or that it was a spec house, and so that the ownership issue does not override the negligent construction and breach of implied warranty issues.
So the fourplex was constructed by the owner and then rented out for a few months and then sold to the first purchaser. Is there any authority that says that when an owner rents out a structure for a few months, that it would defeat the cause of action for implied warranty?
I'm not aware of any authority, Your Honor. I just reiterate that it's our position that the focus on those cases is on who the property is constructed for. In this case, what we have is the record we have, and what that reveals is that the properties were built, they were leased out, the ownership issues may be muddled in between there, but that this property was not built for Mr. Ayersman. It wasn't built purely for spec because it was rented out. In conclusion, I would just state to this court that when a close reading of the allegations are made and how it's tied into the testimony of the plaintiff Ayersman, there are a lot of assumptions and speculations made, and it's not defendant's burden in these type of cases to come up with affirmative evidence to defeat those causes of action. They have to present specific genuine issues of material fact. We feel that they did not meet their burden in this case and that the trial court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morgans. Mr. Henderson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. A few points that I'd like to address just briefly. One, Justice Zinter, I believe you asked Mr. Morgans about the question of whether who is the general contractor and whether there is a dispute as to that. Our position is that Doug Booth admitted in his answer, a judicial admission, that he was the general contractor responsible for the sale of the property. He's never amended that. He's never sought to amend that. We believe that that absent amendment, that judicial admission is binding on Doug Booth. But at the very least, that creates a question of fact, I think, as to who the general contractor was. There's also some discussion about, well, the implied warranty, how does that apply in terms of who the property was constructed for? We would agree that there's no evidence that it was specifically constructed for Scott Ehrschman. But I think that a fair reading of the entire record certainly suggests that the property was constructed for the purpose of putting it out for sale to the general public and anyone who might be interested in purchasing it.
What was the time frame?
The property, I believe, was completed. The fourplexes, I believe, were completed. Well, the property was completed, I think, in April of 2002. March of 2003 was when the first purchase agreement was signed. So there was a span of almost a year. But if you look at the listing agreement, the listing agreement indicates that property is just being completed at that time. While the listing agreement isn't dated, that certainly suggests that the listing agreement was produced and the property was listed for sale at about the same time the property was being completed in terms of the construction. So there's no indication that Doug Muth built this property, thought, I'm going to build these fourplexes and this tenplex and rent them out with the idea that he would keep them himself. Clearly the intention from the beginning was that he was building these for the purpose of selling them to the general public. The fact that he didn't find a willing buyer until nearly a year later after completion of the construction really doesn't matter as to what his intent was.
Why wasn't it ever raised by the court or you or whatever that there weren't any attached statements of undisputed fact?
Justice Meyerhane, that's another point I did want to respond to, and there is a statement of undisputed facts that is filed was filed with the trial court, and I believe it starts at page 13 of the record.
It's not attached to any of the briefs.
It's not attached to the briefs, no.
What page is that?
I believe it starts at page 13 of the certified record, and it has a number of attachments to it and goes to page 31.
And that was filed by the by Muth?
That was filed by Doug Muth in conjunction with his motion for summary judgment.
And did you object to those?
We did file a response to those statements of undisputed fact in which we indicated which factual allegations we disputed and pointed to evidence in the record supporting our belief that there was a factual dispute as to those allegations. And so I think that is all in the record to be looked at. Justice Meyerhinder, you also had a question as to, you know, when the trial court specifically adopts its memorandum decision and its order, can you go outside of that in terms of affirming summary judgment? I know there are those cases that say that summary judgment can be affirmed by any basis supported by the record. I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, but the way I would answer, at least for purposes of this case, is that in this case there is no other basis for summary judgment that is supported by the record. There's a lot of, you know, conjecture and allegations that, well, gee, maybe Jeremy Muth wasn't really Doug Muth's agent and things like that, but there's no affirmative evidence that was ever set forth regarding those things.
Well, our review is de novo, you know, summary judgment, so we can look at anything that's in the record.
Right. That's correct, Justice Kohlenkamp. And our position would be that there's nothing in the record that would support the new positions essentially relied upon by the appellee in this case.
What is your response to Mr. Morgan's comment that there's no reliance testimony in the record?
My response would be twofold. First of all, there seemed to be some confusion or at least I was confused as to whether Mr. Morgan was taking the position that the reliance element would apply to all of our causes of action. I think it's clear that to the extent reliance is relevant, it's relevant with respect to the fraud claim and the negligent misrepresentation claim. It doesn't have any bearing on our negligence claim or our implied warranty claim. Secondly, I will acknowledge that there's no evidence in which Doug or Scott Erishman testifies directly, I relied upon this, but he certainly testifies that the representation was made to him that the property before sale, that the property was, the siding was maintenance-free. He certainly testifies that he received the listing exhibit identifying the property as maintenance-free prior to the sale. And I think a fair reading, if you look at pages 50 and 51 of the record, which are excerpts from his deposition testimony, I think that a fair reading of his entire testimony on those issues suggests that he did, in fact, rely on the representation. There's also been some argument that that there really was at the trial court level, the defendant's position was there were no representations at all made by Doug Muth to Scott Erishman, therefore there can't be a fraud or negligent misrepresentation claim. And as I said before, we acknowledge that there weren't any direct communications between them, and we're relying on the listing agreement in which Jeremy Muth indicates the property is maintenance-free. Now, it's clear that suggestion that the property, that the siding was maintenance-free was in fact false. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that, you know, a month later, a month after sale, immediately they began having problems with the siding, buckling and coming off in the wind. And the other reason for that is when the property was inspected, when Scott Erishman brought out an engineer to look at it, it was also discovered that there had been a number of screws which were not part of the original installation of the siding that had at some point prior to the sale been added to the siding, presumably in an attempt to deal with this very type of issue, this buckling and siding coming loose. So there's clearly evidence that somebody experienced a problem with the siding prior to sale and took some effort to try to remedy that. You know, there's no direct testimony as to who did that, and I don't know that anyone has acknowledged doing that, but Doug Muth was the general contractor responsible for the sale of the property by his own admission. He was the owner, he was the seller, and I think that creates a question of fact as to whether or not he had knowledge that the siding was not, in fact, maintenance-free and that there had, in fact, been prior problems with the siding prior to sale. Another argument that is made, I just wanted to address very briefly, is the notion that you know, any representation made was a representation as to future events. Again, I would just respond by saying that a representation that siding is maintenance-free does not just extend to future events. It is a representation of the character and the nature of the siding at the time the representation is made. And if, in fact, that siding had not been maintenance-free in the past, and if, in fact, there had been prior problems with the siding and prior attempts to resolve those problems unsuccessfully, then that's not just a representation as to a future event. That's a representation concerning the current existing nature and character of the siding. I have nothing further to add other than what I've said already, unless you have any questions.
There being none, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.